From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Today on the program, Milwaukee's Public Policy Forum gives the city's proposed budget high marks, at least in one key respect.
In terms of a fiscally responsible budget, without question, should that lead your listeners to believe that the city's financial problems are taken care of? Absolutely not.
A revised book explores the modern challenges facing Wisconsin's Indian nations. Then a Wisconsin poet's work is the catalyst for an exhibit by three visual artists.
It was exciting to see how the artists dealt with the poems, and humbling. I mean, these three amazing women have created some astounding artwork for the poems, and I've been very humbled by that.
And a behind-the-scenes look at the national tour of Jersey Boys, now in Milwaukee. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Now that the economic impasse has been resolved in Washington, the local focus moves on to Milwaukee's city and county budgets. Mayor Tom Barrett and County Executive Chris Abley have both issued their proposed budgets for the coming fiscal year, and debate on those documents is underway. The nonpartisan Public Policy Forum this week issued its analyses of those proposals. Forum President Rob Hankin spoke about their budget briefs with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and addressed what he sees as the common theme in both proposed budgets.
Well, I think actually there's quite a few similarities between the fiscal predicament of the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. Common themes are, number one, very large employer pension contributions that crowd out other needs. Number two, aging infrastructure that requires some serious attention. And number three, very stagnant, if not declining, state and federal aids.
So let's look first at the proposed county budget, if we could. And you start by looking back 5 years and the budget situation that was then on life support or intensive care. How has the situation changed since the economy and the budget was in that deep trough?
By far, the most remarkable change has been on the healthcare front. Healthcare inflation has been 8 to 10% roughly for not only Milwaukee County and other public sector employers, but private sector employers as well. And the county has actually been able to reduce its healthcare spending over the past several years. Now, that is linked to a variety of things, not the least of which was the adoption of Wisconsin Act 10, which gave the county the flexibility to unilaterally implement some very substantial changes to its healthcare offerings, increasing healthcare premiums, putting a lot more of a burden on county employees to share the cost of rising healthcare. The county also took some other steps in terms of plan design that simply were able to save it money. Now, mind you, Act 10 also produced some negative consequences for county government in terms of the loss of, not directly related to Act 10, but the state budget that followed Act 10 had some significant cuts, not only in state shared revenues, but in transit funding and in other aid programs that did harm the county. But on balance, I think it's these healthcare savings, the ability also to see several successive years of positive returns on the pension fund. So while the pension contribution skyrocketed for several successive years, we've now seen it stabilize and even decline a little bit. I think the county's issuance of pension obligation bonds, it got the timing exactly right. I think everybody would admit that was more luck than skill, but the fact is that it worked, and that too is reaping some dividends.
Well, I think it was last year that you posed the question about how long the county could keep looking to things like employee health care costs to achieve savings. How would you compare the proposed budget for the next fiscal year as far as health care goes to what was accomplished in the current year's budget?
Well, I think it is one of the most interesting elements of this year's county budget, and really to me one of the most interesting elements as we think about how Act 10 is going to play out across the state. There were some very large initial savings to be gained when the flexibility was granted to local governments. The question is, as we raised last year, can you continue to ask your employees to pay more for their health care, considerably more every year? Is that a sustainable strategy in terms of workplace, workforce morale, and recruitment and retention? And many people do need to pay more for their health care every year. The problem is that the health care premium changes that are being proposed in this year's budget do exceed exceed the wage increases, so that for the third successive year, most county employees are going to see an overall decline in their compensation. So what we're seeing this year, Mitch, is a change in the premiums. There is not the plan design that we've seen in previous years. There's not an effort to deal with copays and deductibles. But employee premiums for their monthly payments are going up. A flexible spending account contribution that the county had been making would go away under the county executive's proposal. And that means that the average employee is going to pay more.
There has been some talk about shifting county workers' health care to the health exchanges created under the Affordable Care Act. Is that something, given the current budget reality, that it would behoove the county to look at?
I think without question would behoove the county to look at it. I think it's still a very preliminary idea. The basic thinking is that when you look at the annual cost of what the county is paying for both families and individuals and compare that to what the cost might be to provide similar coverage under the healthcare exchange, it appears at first glance that there might be a substantial savings there. But I think there's a lot of detail that still needs to be worked out. And really, in the budget, there's a paragraph saying, we want to look at this, but I don't think they're counting on those savings yet.
You also write with some concern about a couple of the proposals, including the extent of the cuts being called for within the sheriff's department.
Yes. And again, what we've seen from this county executive now for three straight years are really the backbone of deficit cutting efforts in terms of trying to gain control of some of these key cost drivers is on the healthcare front and in the sheriff's budget. So for the third straight year, we're seeing major changes proposed. We are also seeing a host of functions transferred out of the sheriff's office and to other county departments. I think where the concern arises is a very legitimate debate can occur about whether, to the extent that the sheriff is performing services that are not necessarily mandated by state law and or that could ostensibly be handled by municipal police departments, I think those are the types of services that you want to have a conversation around, can they be reduced? But when it comes to these mandated services, to running the jail, expressway patrol, things of that nature, I think the concern is that there has been so much cutting over the past several years that even those core mandated services, the sheriff may have trouble performing at the level that he needs to, particularly given that the corrections population appears to again be on the rise. So that's where we think that some discussion needs to occur.
Let's talk about the proposed city budget. And we talked about this last year as well. You cite good planning back in 2010 as a key reason for the relatively strong fiscal position the city is in today.
Yes. The city leaders, to their credit, had a lot of foresight. They saw the way the city pension fund works. They knew that the real hit from the decline in the value of their pension fund that came from the 2008 and 2009 stock market decline. There was an initial hit in the 2010 budget, and then they knew there was going to be another big hit in 2013. And so what they did is in 2011 and 2012, they socked away more than $40 million into a pension reserve. What we've now seen in the 13 budget and now in the mayor's proposed budget for 14 is gradually drawing down that reserve while they are also gradually ramping up the amount of property tax levy that needs to be committed to the pension fund as a way to sort of smooth out the pain. I think the result is that largely services are being maintained. Now, is that good enough, I think, is a legitimate question that can be asked. But they've been able to avoid some major pain in terms of service cuts because of this very foresightful strategy.
The pension fund is not a completely solved problem at this point. There are some looming challenges down the road.
Yes. And so what they've done, another change that was made more recently, was to construct the employer contribution in a way that it's going to be level so that they don't have to try to accommodate these big swings up and down. But they know that going forward, it's going to be a set percentage of payroll, which is going to be roughly in the $62-63 million per year range. So good news, it's going to be smooth. We can plan for it. Bad news, $62 or $63 million, when you consider that the overall city property tax levy is in the $250 million range, that's a lot of money.
What are the other key looming challenges you see the city facing in the near-term future, the next several years anyway?
Well, the city, like the county, has been able to recognize some really remarkable healthcare savings. And so similar question as to the county. Are those going to be exhausted? What happens when healthcare starts rising again at 4, 5, 6% per year? That's a big number that the city has to accommodate. Again, the city's aging infrastructure, local streets and buildings and so on, is going to demand some substantial attention. Now, if their revenue streams have some elasticity to them, those aren't as big a problem, particularly because because now the rate of growth of healthcare is projected at 4% versus the former 8 or 9%. The problem is their revenue capacity is very limited. They are even more reliant than the county on state shared revenue. That revenue stream has been flat, actually took a big hit in the previous state budget. And so the city has very little wherewithal other than some raising fees and the limited ability to increase the property tax to accommodate these rising expenditure needs.
You do point to a couple of specific areas that you say deserve extra credit, the foreclosure initiative and street repairs.
Yeah. So when you look at the city budget, again, for those who are reading the newspapers about the murder rate going up, and obviously we are aware of some very severe poverty issues in the city of Milwaukee, we're not seeing a lot in terms of new initiatives there. But there are two areas in which certainly great attention is being paid. One is the foreclosure initiative, which obviously does have an impact on city poverty. And about $11 million is being put into a variety of strategies to combat the impact of foreclosed properties in the city. And we do see a continued commitment to try to make sure that the replacement cycles for local streets and roads is up to date and that we're taking care of the major problems in the city's infrastructure.
So in short, you give the city's budget pretty high marks.
In terms of a fiscally responsible budget, without question, should that lead your listeners to believe that the city's financial problems are taken care of? Absolutely not. And again, the big question is, to the extent that the city would need to generate the wherewithal to put additional resources into major problems, the capacity to do so is very limited.
Rob, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rob Hankin is the president of the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. He spoke with Mitch Tyke. There are links to the forum's analyses of the proposed Milwaukee city and county budgets from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. Coming up, a revised edition of a book on Wisconsin's Indian nations captures their modern history. That's next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Earlier this week, Governor Scott Walker called for a meeting with the leaders of Wisconsin's 11 Indian tribes to discuss plans for a Menominee casino in Kenosha. The plan, which also includes a partnership with Hard Rock International, is strongly opposed by the Potawatomi tribe. It says the project would take away business from its Milwaukee casino. For UW-Madison professor Patty Lowe, the casino debate is just one of the modern challenges facing Wisconsin's Indian tribes. But as she's documented in her book, Indian Nations of Wisconsin, they have also endured and made great advancements in the last several decades. The book is now in its second edition, and Patty Lowe joins me to talk about the tribe's histories. Patty, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Now, this is the second edition of Indian Nations of Wisconsin. Why did you want to write an updated version?
I had serious regrets almost immediately after the first edition was written because I didn't have a chapter on urban Indians. And more than half of all Native people in Wisconsin live in Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, and other urban areas in Wisconsin. So it was a serious omission on my part, I'm afraid. And then when I originally wrote the book, the first edition, the brother town were sort of awkwardly piggybacked onto the Mohican chapter because there was very little known about them. They were just beginning the federal acknowledgement process. They were terminated back in the 1830s and have been attempting to be a federally recognized tribe ever since then. And it wasn't until the last decade, that effort got some traction. And so now there was material in order to justify a complete chapter on the brother town.
Obviously, each tribe has experienced different things, but have you noticed in the last 13 years certain trends in terms of what the different tribes throughout Wisconsin have been experiencing?
Well, certainly with the Ojibwe, the big challenge has been mining. And back in the mid-1990s, the Mole Lake Ojibwe or Sacaugan Ojibwe and the Forest County Potawatomi And to a lesser extent, the Menominee and Oneida were facing a large sulfide copper mine. And those tribes, in connection with a lot of mainstream environmental groups, were able to meet that challenge. And in fact, the Potawatomi and the Mole Lake actually purchased the mine site in order to prevent that area from becoming a sulfide mine. Currently, the Bad River Ojibwe are facing a massive open pit taconite mine at the headwaters of their Rice River. And so mining especially is something that quite a number of the tribes are very concerned about. The other issue that I think is a common theme is the land into trust issue.
Well, what does that mean, land into trust?
What it means is the Oneida have been buying back land that was originally part of their reservation and putting that land back into trust through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And reservation land is not taxable. And so the land that passed out of their hands because of the Allotment Act in the 19th century, the Oneida lost more than 90% of their land. And so now they've been buying it back and putting it back into trust. Well, that land is coming off municipal tax rolls and increasing the burden, individual tax burden for non-Indians in those municipalities. And the way the Oneida have met it is to negotiate service agreements, you know, paying for roads or paying for police or fire protection or those kinds of municipal services in order to ease the tax burden on individual mainstream taxpayers.
What do both of these issues, both the land into trust and the environmental concerns, tell us about how Indian tribes are organizing and their political agency today in Wisconsin?
Well, certainly the recognition of sovereignty and treaty rights, something that really began in the 1970s and really we're seeing it now. And surrounding municipalities are starting to understand that there is another layer of government between municipal government, state government, U.S. government. Now we're reminded that there are tribal governments as well. And so it tells us that Native communities are beginning to flex some of that political muscle.
We're talking with Patty Lowe about the second edition of her book, Indian Nations of Wisconsin. Patty, you include a new chapter in this edition on urban Indians. Why do they need their own chapter?
I think because the urban experience for Native people is a unique one. It's a pan-Indian environment. You have people from tribes all over the country who are trying to retain their identity as Native people. However, they don't have access to the services that their tribal nations would normally provide for them. Health, education, welfare, all those things that we as citizens, whether you're a Native citizen or a U.S. citizen or a state citizen, enjoy in our lives. And Native people don't have access to that in many cases. And so they've had to create a different kind of social network and social service network in Milwaukee, as an example. But imagine in the 1950s, your family arrives because you've answered an ad basically from the Bureau of Indian Affairs that tells you, come, move to the city. And you see the brochure has beautiful gleaming skyscrapers and happy Native people doing mainstream type jobs. And you've been promised that you'll get job retraining and that your life in the city is going to be wonderful. And instead, basically what you have is a one-way bus ticket to the center of town and directions to a flop house. And now not only are you cut off from your tribal services, but you're cut off from your culture and your language and your ceremonies. And it's been a real struggle for Native people. And, we do see some successes because of organizations like the American Indian Chamber of Commerce and the First American Capital Corporation and some of the other economic engines that we've seen come up, grow in Milwaukee. Indian Summer Festival, more than anything for me, really embodies how far urban Indians have come. And, if I can get just a little personal, my mother, who has lived in Milwaukee most of her life, told me she cried after that first Indian Summer Fest because, for so long, she was made to feel like she should be embarrassed and apologized for her Native identity. And here, you know, this celebration of Native culture, you know, for the first time as an urban Indian made her feel proud. And, you know, I think that's not an overstatement. I think a lot of Native people of her generation really, really look at festivals and celebrations, the resurgence of powwows, that really are a great source of pride for them.
For as many successes as the tribes in Wisconsin have had, there still permeates throughout the media stories of where there are struggles when it comes to health care, issues with alcoholism, low employment rates. What is the situation? What is the real situation on the ground for tribes here in Wisconsin? Where are the struggles? Where are the successes? And where are the tribes really making strides toward improving the situation of natives both on reservation lands and also within our urban communities?
That's such a good question, and it really speaks to the title of the book, Histories of Endurance and Renewal, because there have been successes. I think some of the tribes have experienced some economic success. We're seeing good housing starts. We see tribal programs expanding. There are daycare programs and Head Start programs, there are elder programs, elder housing, Meals on Wheels. There's a really strong sense of land stewardship and a lot of programs involving brownfields, let's say, you know, with St. Croix. They've done a lot of reclamation of brownfields. There are media centers like those at Lac-Couturier. The Forest County Potawatomi are almost completely off the grid because of a really very visionary energy program that the tribe has instituted over the past, I'd say, 6 or 7 years. The Menominee, there's this resurgence of their sturgeon ceremonies, and their forest is as healthy as any forest on the planet. But there are those challenges. Diabetes is a huge problem in some of the Native communities. Almost 60% of the population over age 50 is either diabetic or pre-diabetic. I mean, that's an incredible challenge. Child obesity is a major problem. Some tribes have better access to health care than others. That's still a challenge for Native people who live off the reservation and perhaps not in an urban area like Indians in Milwaukee who have access to the Ignace Health Center. So these are some of the vestiges of land loss and really generational trauma, I think, caused by the boarding school experience. Beginning in the late 19th century, you had tens of thousands of Native children who were removed from their homes, placed in government facilities or Christian boarding schools. It was illegal for them to practice their religions or speak their language or maintain any of their culture. And, you know, some of these children, my grandfather, for example, was taken at age 4. And their education really, I think you could argue, was a second-class education. And so, you know, you take these children out of their environment at age 4 and you give them a problematic education, and then they go back into their communities. They don't speak the language. They haven't experienced, you know, what it's like to be a member of a family and be shown love and show love and affection. And now these people grow up and they become parents, and they, you know, that they don't have that good foundation. So that brings with it all the, you know, the drinking and drug problems as people try to just sort of self-medicate and not deal with a fundamental issue like that. So, you know, we're making strides, but we still have these very real problems that we're trying to come to grips with.
What do you see will continue to be issues, and where do you think strength will grow?
Well, I'm an optimist. So the fact that tribes are reasserting their sovereignty and beginning to really act like nations and do what nations do, which is to provide for their people and protect their natural resources, I think we'll see more of that going forward. I think that the gaming operations that provided a first tier of economic infrastructure, now some of the tribes are beginning to spin off and create a second tier of economic infrastructure.
You mentioned the gaming industry, and I know that one of the big stories going on right now is the contention between the Potawatomi and their casino here in Milwaukee, and the Menominees plan to build another casino in Kenosha. What do you make of that situation?
Well, I think it was a very deliberate attempt by the state to drive a wedge between the tribes. When you say we'll only allow another casino, but no new net casino, so somebody has to give up a casino and everybody has to agree, well, that wasn't going to happen. And I think everyone knew it wasn't going to happen. And so I think it was kind of a disingenuous path to take. Certainly, the Potawatomi are trying to protect their own economic interests in the southeastern part of the state, and the Menominee Casino in Kenosha, from the Potawatomi perspective, would be seen as considerable competition. Looking at it from the Menominee perspective, this is a tribe that was improperly terminated in the 1950s, and they are still trying to recover from termination. And it, you know, the Menominee are one of the most economically challenged tribes. So certainly as that tribe moves forward to try to provide as best it can for its people, it's going to be looking at opportunities to do that. And the, you know, the old dog track in Kenosha is a means to an end.
Well, Patty Lowe, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Patty Lowe is the author of Indian Nations of Wisconsin, Histories of Endurance and Renewal, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. She's an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe and a professor at UW-Madison. Up next, if a picture is worth a thousand words, how many pictures is a poem worth? We'll untangle the inspiration behind a new exhibit when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. An exhibition opening this weekend at the Cedarburg Cultural Center is the result of a collaboration between visual artists and a wordsmith. Text and Texture, artwork inspired by the words of W.A. Reed, includes the paintings of Claudette Lee Roseland and Deb Mortal, the black-and-white photography of Vicky Reed, and the poetry of Buzz Reed. This is not the first time the two Reeds have collaborated. They're also husband and wife, and for more than a decade produced the Porcupine Literary Arts magazine together. Vicky and Buzz Reed joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in the studio and talked about what led them to explore a shared artistic vision for this new exhibit.
Well, I had won a solo show last year in 2013, and I had done previous shows just by myself, showcasing the different processes I use to accomplish the finished piece. And I wanted to have a different approach to this show. So I decided to invite two other artists to join me and my husband. And I thought the one way to bring all the work together was through the written word. The two other artists that are in the show with me do very colorful abstracts. I do black and white. And so I was looking for a way to join all the pieces together. And Buzz's poetry is the thread that runs through the entire exhibit.
Well, and I would imagine it could easily have been, let's take some existing artwork and some existing poetry and join them together. But how did you end up conceiving of what exactly the exhibit would become?
Well, much of the poetry existed prior to the show. In fact, most of it. I think there was one piece written as a result of a photograph that Vicky had taken. But there were a lot of visual issues in the poems themselves, colors, textures, so it seemed to be a natural fit. It was exciting to see how the artists dealt with the poems, and humbling. I mean, these three amazing women have created some astounding artwork for the poems, and I've been very humbled by that.
Vicky, talk about the process of deciding which poems would drive the work that you as the visual artists would create.
Well, Buzz had published a collection of poetry a few years ago. And so we had a book of poetry, and I just passed it on to the two artists and said, asked them if they thought they would be able to create a body of work, if there was enough meat in those poems to inspire them. And they were very enthusiastic about trying to do that. So for several months, I had no idea what poems they were working on, what art they were creating. We worked independently. And about 3 months ago, we came together to see what we had all created, and it was extremely exciting to see the finished pieces.
Tell us about who the other two artists are that are represented in this exhibition and why you thought their work gelled so well with what the two of you already create.
Well, both Deb and Claudette have been working in art for many years. Deb is actually a high school art teacher at Cedarburg High School. Claudette has taught for many years. They both work in abstract with a lot of color. They both like texture. And I recently began working in encaustic, which involves wax, allows me to embed different textured papers in my work and add texture to my work. So I knew that that was a good basis for all of us. Plus, we have their artwork in our house and have admired it for many years. So I was excited to be able to work with these two wonderful artists.
Now, this is not the first time the two of you have collaborated. How do you see this exhibition comparing to what you did with the literary magazine that you published for more than a decade?
Well, Porcupine Literary Arts Magazine really gave us a great background for putting together the book, text and texture. For both of us, Vicky in particular, kind of curating the show. Deb Mortal and Claudette Lee Roseland both were just fun to work with because they just latched onto the poems, and every day we'd hear, well, I've created a piece from this poem or from that poem. So I think Porcupine really gave us that great start. And we met so many artists and so many writers in publishing Porcupine from across the country, actually.
What is it like as the poet to have the words, the written words, jump it's not even jumping off the page, but jump into an entirely different dimension?
Well, what's fun is, you know, for me as a writer, people frequently will ask, what's this poem about or what's the meaning of that poem? And to me, that meaning belongs with the reader or the observer, not with the writer. I purposely write some ambiguity into my poems so that they can be interpreted by a variety of people. And to see the artist interpret these poems in different ways was thrilling. And in one case, I had written a poem as an interpretation of a painting by a Milwaukee area artist named Katie Ruth, who is now deceased, but a painting that I enjoyed very much. And these painters then reinterpreted the poem into paintings of their own without having seen Katie's piece, which I thought was kind of an interesting process as well.
Is there a certain amount of letting go you have to do as the poet and say, I'm going to accept whatever interpretation these other artists come up with, rather than worrying about, well, do they get my poem?
Not at all. I don't feel that I own the interpretation. That's certainly was left in the hands of the painters, and I'm happy to have it there, and I'm happy to see the results.
Well, I was hoping you could share an example of at least one or two poems that you wrote. And Vicky, I'll be curious to hear how you went about interpreting it.
Sure. This first poem is entitled From Out East, and it kind of documents our movement to this state of Wisconsin from Maine originally. We both grew up in Maine, and so it kind of ties the two locations in some ways. From out east comes the blue house with lace at the windows and a rising full moon. In the face of pretense flies the tired complacency reflected in the eyes of painters and poets, the incorrigible dreamers gone out in a blizzard of yellow taxicabs to spill this separate and conditional peace. From out east comes the literature, words written out like a declaration. And the culture and the history of a civilized society rejoice in the rising sun and in the grandeur of cities, pool in the deep and infinite sky. A stubborn persistence held the hand of the working man who turned these forested farm fields to cedar fence rails with lichened stone and the split ash baskets of potatoes and fruit. From out east comes a light breeze rustling the leaves, reminding us of home. Collars turned up against the cold, damp air, fingers dug into the pockets of a camel hair coat. Our hearts are warmed from the shine of good intentions, from the blue house with lace at the windows, and the frozen laundry pinned to a clothesline, waiting for someone, waiting for someone.
I can hear a little of the Maine in this.
I haven't completely lost my accent.
So, Vicki, how did you approach that?
Well, there are so many images that formed in my head that I could have jumped on. But one thing came to mind in that I'm very drawn to water. We have a cottage up north, which is a wonderful escape for us. And so I decided to go with the full moon rising, and I took a primitive toy, plastic Holga camera, and did a night exposure of the moon rising. I had no idea what would come out, if any image would form, but it
That's
did.
That's the beauty of a Holga.
Right. And so I was really pleased when I developed the film and saw that I actually had a moody image that brought the poem to life for me.
Has Buzz's poetry shaped your photography in a broader way? I mean, do you think about words when you're taking pictures?
I do now. I've never really worked from, you know, trying to be inspired by his poetry, or I don't usually try to work in a theme mode. I started out working as a daily news photographer, so I became used to having my mind's eye turned on constantly to be able to create images that would be appropriate for the newspaper. And so when I stopped working for the newspaper and had the opportunity to just shoot for myself, I just shoot whatever pleased me. But with this project, it focused my efforts, and I found it liberating to be able to explore all kinds of different processes in order to create work for this. With his canoe poem, My Canoe, that he has written, he describes what his canoe is. And my reaction to that was, well, what would my canoe be? And one of the things I decided was my canoe would be a kayak. So I've created an image for that. Plus, I've created an entire series of three-dimensional boats, origami boats that have encaustic, that are related to my canoe poem, but also to the other poems that are in the exhibit.
Well, is there one more poem you want to share with us?
Well, I guess I should read My Canoe. Vicki spends a lot of time in her kayak photographing, and we travel a lot together. And so I spend a lot of time waiting and take that opportunity to craft poems. So My Canoe was actually written at our cabin up in northern Wisconsin, and as Vicki says, it conjured up images for her as well as the painters themselves. My canoe prefers calm weather, the solitary sojourner, a man to a woman. It chooses the easy strokes, measured and precise, a slow, lazy glide to part blue-green waters, balance my solitary selves.
Not to put words in your mouth, but this must be a fairly special exhibition for both of you.
It is. When I had laid out the work in the form of a book to accompany the exhibit, and Buzz looked through the book for the first time to see the images that all three of us had created with his poems, he was absolutely speechless, which was amazing. Yes. And so it was obvious that he was very, very moved, very touched, and he should be.
When somebody creates artwork from the written word, I mean, it's a close analysis of the poem in question. So to get that detailed analysis of something that I'd written was, as I've said, humbling and enjoyable to see what direction it took each of these women in.
It's nice to be heard.
Yes. And seen.
Well, Vicki Reed, Buzz Reed, thank you so much, both of you, and best of luck with the exhibit.
Thank you very much.
Photographer Vicki Reed and poet Buzz Reed's work will be on display in the exhibit Text and Texture, artwork inspired by the words of W.A. Reed, which opens Sunday at the Cedarburg Cultural Center. They spoke with Mitch Tyke. The exhibit also features the paintings of artists Deb Mortal and Claudette Lee Roseland. You'll find links to more about the artists and the exhibit from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The musical Jersey Boys comes to Wisconsin, and it's a homecoming for one of its stars. We'll meet him when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. If you didn't know, those are the inimitable sounds of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Well, maybe they are imitable. After all, the hit Broadway musical Jersey Boys is based on the group's story and songs. It's enjoyed a long run on Broadway and for the last couple of years has been bringing their beloved tunes to cities across the country in its national tour. The show opened its Milwaukee run yesterday, and as it turns out, there's a little Wisconsin in Jersey. Actor Barry Anderson is a Wisconsin native who plays the role of the Four Seasons producer Bob Crew in the production. He's here in studio with me now. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting.
Well, we're excited to have you. Barry, I want to start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your career. Did you always have dreams of performing on Broadway in national tours across the country?
I guess so. I think I did. I don't know if I had dreams of it, but I was definitely drawn to music and drawn to performing as a kid. I would do everything I could to do the school programs and the church programs and anything to get me on stage. My dad is a musician, and so there was always music in the house, and I think his side of the family was definitely where I got a lot of my love for all of that stuff. So growing up, listening to cast recordings was just a daily thing for me. I'd play Fiddler on the Roof from front to back three times in one day, and then it would be The Sound of Music the next day and Annie the next day. You know, it was like those cast albums that we all kind of grew up with.
Well, when would you say was your big break?
I was lucky enough to work on Broadway a few years back in Legally Blonde, the musical. And that for me was a really exciting thing because at that point I was living in New York, and to be able to actually live in the city and go to work at night in the city is like a huge goal for a lot of New York actors. You know, a lot of times we move to the city to get a tour and take us out of town or get regional work that takes us out of town. So just to be able to have that life for a bit was, yeah, I guess you could say a dream come true.
Yeah. So tell us about getting on the national tour for Jersey Boys. How has that experience differed from being set in one place on Broadway?
Yeah. Well, the show itself is basically the same as you would see in New York. The thing that's different is that every 2 or 3 weeks, we're picking up and flying to another big city to go give our show to a whole new group of people who maybe have never seen it or maybe have never been to New York City, maybe have never seen a Broadway show on Broadway. But thankfully, there are a lot of opportunities in all these theaters across the country for them to go see a Broadway caliber performance in their own, you know, hometown.
Do you feel like the audiences respond differently depending on where they are?
Definitely. Oh, my gosh. Yes. It's really interesting, actually. We were just in Waterbury, Connecticut last week, and they were nuts for the show. I mean, they were on their feet. Sometimes in the middle of a scene, they'd be talking back just out of enthusiasm, of course. But something about that New England, East Coast, there's some sort of ownership with the show out there, I found. We opened the show in Philly, in Philadelphia, and we're headed back there over the holidays this year, too. So a lot of the audiences, too, I feel like by the end of the 2.5 hours, believe some people are truly convinced that they're watching the actual group. Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. I feel that that is the case for some people. Granted, we're all just actors portraying the roles and stuff. And then, you know, you've got those audiences in some parts of the country who totally love the show, but they just kind of sit back and take it all in and they'll clap politely and then they'll be on their feet cheering and dancing at the end. You know, so it totally differs. It's interesting to watch that as one of the most interesting things about touring a show, for sure.
Now, in the production, you play the real-life character Bob Crew, who was the producer and co-writer of so many of the Four Seasons songs. How much research did you do going into that role to prepare to really present him?
Mm-hmm. Quite a lot, actually. And what was helpful for us when we opened this tour, we were in a rehearsal room for 4 weeks in New York City all together. From the ground up, we kind of built this show. And almost a week's worth of that time was spent on the dramaturgy side of everything. So it was just sitting around a table talking about these real people, getting all of the factoids from the Jersey Boys Bible, what they call this huge binder of information and documents and pictures. And we had YouTube clips to watch.
What surprised you the most about what you learned about the Four Seasons and the creative team that put together their sound and their style?
I think it was just the fact that they had this kind of dark-sided story to their rise to fame tale. Our show kind of portrays the behind the music story of this iconic group, which everyone knows they're big hits. You don't think about what happened behind the scenes. Most people don't know who Bob Crew was. I mean, Frankie Valli is the face and the voice of the group, but there were three other group members in the Four Seasons, Nick, Tommy, and Bob Gaudio, and then their producer, Bob Crew, who was prolific in his own way as a producer and had a lot of interests. He was into visual arts and he was a model for a while, and early in his career, he did have a career as a recording soloist, but then got into producing and worked with a ton of people all the way up through the 80s. He wrote Lady Marmalade.
Yeah, there are so many songs that he wrote that. Yeah. What's another one that he wrote? Good Morning Starshine from Hair.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I found so interesting when I was even researching him, because I've seen the show twice.
Okay.
And even though in the musical they explain his really important role, you know, I still had to go and do research about Bob Crew and to learn how much of an influence he had on music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Oh, yeah.
It's just incredible.
Yeah. The Bob Crew Generation was a group that he had in the 70s. Prolific. I mean, he really was. The catalog of what he did is huge. And so, yeah, diving into all of that stuff, reading up about it, reading interviews with him, with people that knew him, all of that stuff was really interesting to me. And then balancing that with what was given to us all on the page of the play, because for dramatic purposes, some of the, you know, especially his stuff pops off the page, let's say. I mean, it's just a blast to play. You know, Bob Gaudio and Frankie Valli were very hands-on with the writers when the show was being created and volleying back and forth like, well, this happened. Well, it wasn't exactly that way. Yes, it was. No, you know, for the most part, they wanted to make sure that it was a warts and all kind of portrayal. You know, let's not gloss over anything. Let's really show it for what it was. And I mean, there are some dark moments in the show, but it's also laugh out loud funny.
I love listening to you talk about this show. You're so enthusiastic about it, even though this tour has been going on now for 2 years. I mean, how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep yourself engaged in this material with that kind of authentic enthusiasm?
Well, knowing that you are playing to a new audience every night is the thing I try to keep in the back of my head. Also, it's a new city and a new theater space. Every time you're in a new theater, your backstage path changes. So you got to keep those muscles going, you know, like where's my dressing room? Where do I have to run to for this quick change? So that's one element that kind of keeps it interesting. Personally, the challenge for us as actors who are lucky enough to be doing the 8 shows a week for years at a time is just that, keeping it new for the brand new set of audiences that come in, knowing that it's the first time that they're hearing and seeing all of this stuff.
Now, you're a songwriter yourself, and I want to ask how that's helped you in playing Bob Crew, knowing, you know, his role in writing the Four Seasons music. Have you been able to appreciate certain things better because of your own songwriting background?
I think so. I like to think so. I mean, it was interesting when we started the show and I had gotten the role. I guess I didn't even think of those two things at all, because I had kind of recently gotten into songwriting a little more. But now that I'm in it and kind of doing both at the same time, I do think about that almost every night on stage. I mean, there are a couple scenes that take place in a recording studio, and I'm in the process right now, actually, of finishing up recording an album of some original stuff. And so I've spent a few days in recording studios over the past couple months. It's art imitating life, life imitating art, I guess. So it's been very fun and interesting to use that stuff and bring it into the show at night.
You talked before about how the audience often comes away learning something about the four seasons that they didn't know before. And one of the things that I know in previous interviews you've mentioned people are surprised to learn about is that Bob Crewe was gay, and yet he was writing these songs about these kind of hard scrabble, straight, working class boys from Jersey. And yet these songs are so universally loved, even during a time when people didn't really identify out loud
gay. No.
What has that been like, bringing that element to the show?
Oh, it's a gift, I think. I mean, it's kind of the last thing people are expecting when my character enters, and there's no mistaking it from the first line. So it kind of takes some people a couple seconds to be like, oh, okay, this is a gay guy, and he's working with this group, and it's in the 60s, and it wasn't talked about a lot. But from everything I've read and heard and talked to people about him at that time, you know, there wasn't a lot of apology for it. It wasn't as though he were really hiding it a lot of the times. And the group, I think Frankie and Bob would attest that there was no mistaking it.
Do you think people are coming to appreciate more the impact Bob Crewe and Bob Gaudio, too? I really shouldn't, you know, be leaving him out. They co-wrote together so often. But do you think people are coming to appreciate the impact, his legacy in the Four Seasons music more today than maybe he'd even gotten attention for in the past?
I think so. I think that's the case. And I hope it's the case, because rightly so. And like we said before, just everything – the people he worked with, the list is endless, you know. And he was there at the genesis of all of that Brill Building era, even around the time of, you know, Carole King starting. All of those famous songwriters that came out of there, that was where he was. I think what Jersey Boys has done for him, as well as Gaudio and even Frankie Valli to a certain extent, is put them back on the map as far as putting a face and a name with those songs that people already knew. I could go on and on. I mean, it's just high quality, harmonic, melodic songs that will stand up and stand up.
Well, so Barry, you're back in Wisconsin, your home state.
Yeah.
What is it like? Obviously, you're from the western part of the state, near Eau Claire, I believe.
Yeah, just south of Eau Claire. I'm from a really small town called Osseo, Wisconsin, which our big claim to fame when I was there growing up was the Norske Nook, which was this pie place. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's still there. And they also have a couple of different locations now. But that was what a lot of people went to Osseo for. But yeah, it was a great place to grow up.
Well, Barry Anderson, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Sure.
Barry Anderson plays Bob Crewe in the national tour of Jersey Boys, playing now at the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts Uline Hall through the 27th. The actor and songwriter hails from Osseo, Wisconsin. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thank goodness it's Friday, and thank goodness you listened to Lake Effect. I hope you can be with us for Lake Effect Weekend tomorrow and Sunday at 3, or join us back here Monday at 10 for more Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.